me introduce myself a little. My name's David Smith. I hope that's who you're expecting. The session here, I actually just heard, I think it's called How Do We Learn During Worship in the booklet. There's no significance in the word being different on my title slide. I just didn't have my booklet with me this morning when I made the title slide. So, the focus of this session is about how learning relates to worship. And I should confess up front, I'm an amateur worshipper and a professional educator. So that's the side of expertise that I'm coming at this from. I'm not a theologian, a pastor, a worship leader. I'm a wry observer of the worship in which I participate. But my own interests and specialisms are in learning. I'm interested in how people learn, and I'm interested in what that has to do with Christian formation. So that's what brings me to this topic. Welcome, come in. I teach here at Calvin College. I actually teach half time in the German department, and the other half I teach some education. But I also direct a research institute that we have called the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning, which focuses on teaching and learning in relation to Christian faith. The web address is pedagogy.net. So if anybody's interested in going and playing there, it's about learning rather than worship again. But you might find something of interest. And I'm not from Michigan. As you might be able to tell. I thought I should introduce myself to let you get used to my voice since you all have an accent. Now where I'm starting from here, my guess is if you took 100 people who were in church on Sunday morning and you asked them what teaching and learning took place at church this morning, my guess is that a lot of them, the first thing they mentioned would be maybe the adult Sunday schools, the children's Sunday schools, and then the sermon. In other words, what they probably identify with teaching and learning would be people standing explaining things to people, and other people sitting listening to those things being explained, maybe taking notes, maybe doing an activity, maybe drawing a picture. My guess is that those 100 people would probably be slow to name the times when they were singing together, the times when they were responding to liturgy together, the times when they were entering and exiting the sanctuary as learning times. We tend to identify teaching and learning with formal instructional processes where somebody does what I'm doing now. The whole of what I'm going to look at this morning is premised on that being much too narrow a slice of teaching and learning. Learning takes place in a lot of other ways and is happening pretty constantly. So I'm going to start with a couple of examples from the classroom context of that, just to tune us into what I'm talking about. I'll gradually shift through to some, I'll offer some framework then for trying to analyse that, and then we'll shift through to some worship examples and see how they tie together. So starting with a school example, my son came home from high school about, I guess it must be 4 years ago now, and he had a worksheet that looked very like this, except it was a little longer, from his religion teacher. Down the left-hand side of the worksheet, he had a list of theological terms: justification, sanctification, kingdom of God, cultural mandate, Trinity, ascension, etc. All good stuff. All stuff that I kind of hoped he knew what those words meant. Down the right-hand side, there was a series of paragraphs defining each of those terms. Kind of like this, except a bit longer. I just did a mock-up here to show the structure, but there was a chunkier paragraph next to each term offering a definition. I think there were 12 of these. And he came home, he said, I have to learn these for homework. There's a test on Friday, would you help me study? I said, sure, I'll help you study. So we sat down, I took the sheet from him, and I started trying to ask him hard questions. Could you put one of these in a sentence for me? Could you tell a story that illustrates one of them? Can you think of any New Testament examples that might be a good illustration for one of them? Can you think of any experiences you've had that might tie in with one of these? I'm not even sure I got that far, because he put up with this behaviour for about 4 minutes. And after 4 minutes or so, he took the sheet from me. I mean, literally, not very far in, he took the sheet from me, tossed it down on the coffee table, and he said, but I don't need to understand them that well. And I've told this story to maybe 4,000 or 5,000 teachers over the few years since it happened. And the scary thing is they all know what he said next. He said, I don't need to understand them that well, because on the test, they're only going to make me match the word with the definition. Now, he's not being lazy at this point, or demotivated, or anti-learning, or whatever. He's actually being pretty rational and a good analyst of pedagogical process. Because if you take a worksheet like this, and if your test is going to be a matching test, right, you've got a word in a paragraph, and you've got to draw lines, or do 1A, or whatever, to match them up. This is how much you need to understand to be able to get everything right. Let's translate the worksheet into Wingdings. I suppose I gave you this worksheet for your homework, and I told you there was a test on Friday, and you knew or had a pretty good idea it was going to be a matching test. What do? Well, you stare at the sheet for long enough until you've memorized the first two characters of each word on the left and the first two characters of each definition on the right. If you do that for a moment, and then either a matching test or a multiple choice test will work the same way, if we then go on to the multiple choice test the next day, then based on your quick memorization, you'll be able to pick out that B is the correct answer, because both B and that word start with a little snowflake. And if you do that successfully enough, you will score 100% on the test, you'll be an A-plus student, and you will understand precisely nothing of what was on the worksheet. You won't even be able to read the language that it's in, but you'll still get 100% on the test. So what my son did at that moment was to correctly identify the kind of learning that was implied by the structure of the learning activity. That had nothing to do with the content, and it had very little to do with the teacher's plan. This teacher was one of the best teachers in his school, tremendously creative, tremendously energetic, doing all kinds of cool things with them. I'm utterly confident that she didn't walk into class that morning with a lesson plan that said, today I'm going to teach my grade 9 students that they don't need to understand Christian theology. And yet later that evening, that's the result that my son's reporting back to me. I don't need to understand this stuff, right, is the way he re-articulates that. Not because of any conscious intent on part of the teacher, not because anybody stood up and said, you don't need to understand this, but because the way the experience had been structured, that was a rational conclusion to come to. Once again, just to push this point a little further, notice this has nothing to do with how spirit-filled the teacher is at this moment, or how much love for the students is in her heart, or what beautiful Christian intentions she has, or any of those kinds of things. It's to do with the structure of the activity. That's communicating in certain ways to my son, and he's drawing those conclusions. And it's interesting that when those conclusions get drawn, and we could go on with more examples of this, it's common for students and people generally not to draw technical conclusions. In other words, my son didn't sit down and say, oh, this is a slightly poorly designed worksheet. If she really wanted to get at the kind of learning she's going for, she should have done X, Y, and Z. My son, what he says is, I don't need to understand it. In other words, what it tends to end up at the user end is a fairly global, general kind of judgment about what's going on that's not that nuanced but nevertheless accurate. So first example here, exhibit A of a situation in which there is learning going on that's not on anybody's conscious agenda, that's actually pretty important for formation. Grade 9 students thinking they don't need to understand theology in a Christian school. And it's not being caught because we haven't fallen through the structure of what we're doing, this learning structure that we're living with it. A second example. One of my students here at Calvin graduated, well, a lot of them graduate, but this particular one graduated, and went to a seminary. Not a seminary near here, but nevertheless a pretty well-known and reputable seminary. During his first semester, he sent me this email and gave me permission to share it. In a class on Anglo-American postmodernity, I've been frustrated by how assignments are designed. We recently received our first paperback, and I was surprised and somewhat amused to find that almost all of the best students, that is, those who have taken the most interest in the material, who have asked the most insightful questions, and whom I just generally like to sit down and have a long talk with about the material, got rather crummy grades. Of about 5 of the students I've talked to, all students who I see as brighter than myself, and who I would like to have look over my work, only one did well, while several did miserably. After talking with different people, I've come to suspect that the reason is these students were not content to simply regurgitate information. We realise that what the professor and TA want is basically a boatload of citations to answer the relatively simple questions. I've been somewhat amused by the result of this because it's made the last first and the first last. Normally C students got mostly A's, while the normally A students got C's, but it's also frustrating because the path of least resistance to an A is intellectual mediocrity. We all laughed at ourselves because we spent hours on a paper that was really an easy A to get B's and C's. What this does, however, is incentivise acquiescence and intellectual apathy. I've run into this now in a few classes and beginning to worry that I will not survive seminary with a shred of intellectual rigour left in me. Now, again, this interesting example to me. I think you can tell from the vocabulary and phraseology that this is not a lazy student who doesn't want to learn. This is one of the better students I've had. And once again, he's taking this particular learning experience that he's been subjected to and he's drawing conclusions that have got nothing to do with what was on the teacher's plan. Nothing to do with what was on the lesson plan for today, which was, we will learn a Christian view of Anglo-American postmodernity, presumably. kind of got every reason to think that this teacher is a fine, upstanding person, that they've thought deeply about post-modernity, that they've done their homework, read their books, got great reading lists, etc. But once again, the way in which this particular learning activity is designed is communicating other messages that are being picked up on by students. And the way students are translating those messages, once again, is not in terms of technical details, it's in terms of formational outcomes, right? I can't be intellectually rigorous and be in seminary. It's a pretty serious outcome for a Christian seminary student. And again, it's coming out of the structure of the learning experience. One more. Just happened a few weeks ago in my own class. I train language teachers here at Calvin. And one day I was demonstrating to them how to do speaking activities in a language class. And they expect me to do little demonstrations, but today I came in and I started the class. I didn't announce this was what I was doing. The first 3 minutes of class, I led them through a speaking activity, and I did it badly. Not badly enough to be clownish so that they could pick up what I was doing, but just systematically badly. I kind of sauntered into class. I fiddled with my papers at the podium for a bit, as if I couldn't find what I was looking for, and kind of messed with the computer, started a minute or two late. Then when I got going, I kind of, my posture was sort of kind of slouched back against the desk, body away from the students, didn't make a lot of eye contact. Started the activity, voice pretty monotone, not a lot of energy in the voice, not a lot of energy in the body posture, pace wasn't good, kind of dragged a little bit. Taught them some new words with some flashcards, but only gave them about two or three repetitions before I then asked them to get into pairs and practice them with each other. They couldn't do that yet. They had no mental image of these words. So the pair work failed because I hadn't given them enough prep. And so on. We don't need to go into the techniques of language teaching. At which point I stopped and I said, right, you've got 2 minutes to write down everything that was terrible about that sequence of teaching. And then I came back in and I taught it properly for 2 minutes, and then we started a discussion. So I simply asked them, I said, what was different about those two stretches of teaching? The first answer that came back from one of the students was a student who immediately raised their hand. She said, the first time round, you didn't care about our answers. Which was actually right on the money. I mean, that was exactly the right response. But again, not picking up on any of the technicalities of what I've just described, but picking up on, if you're not making eye contact with me, if you're not leaning towards me, if you can't be bothered to put any of your energy into what you're doing, if you ask me a question and then immediately turn to the next student, almost before I finished articulating my answer, then you don't care about me. So once again, a bigger, more sort of formational conclusion being drawn by the student out of that experience. We could multiply these kinds of examples. So this is the kind of thing that I've got in mind, is you come into a setting and the official agenda is only the top of the iceberg in terms of what you're learning, in terms of how you're being formed, in terms of what kinds of thoughts and attitudes and habits and behaviours and so on are gradually being formed in you through participating in this particular community of practice at this moment in time. We learn by taking part, and we draw conclusions from the ways in which we're asked to take part. And I want to draw for a few minutes from this book. It's by a sociologist. His name is Etienne Wenger. He's Swiss. Works out of Los Angeles, though. It's called Communities of Practice, Learning, Meaning and Identity. When I assign this book to education students, they often think in the first chapter that I assigned the wrong book, because the first chapter is a lengthy and detailed description of a day in the life of a medical insurance claims processing agent. Describes how she comes to her desk, how the things are arranged on the desk, what phone calls she takes, etc., etc. And what he's trying to get at is to describe how in an office environment you just take part in doing stuff and gradually you learn how to be this person. You learn how to function in this kind of environment. Most of that doesn't come through people giving you 20-minute lectures about it. Most of it comes through just operating in this environment and picking up its rhythms and picking up its expectations and watching what other people do. And you gradually become the creature of this environment. You become like other medical insurance claims processors in ways that might even leak out beyond the workplace into the kind of personality that you have in your outside life. So what Ben is trying to draw out of this is an account of what happens when we get together in groups and how that causes learning to happen, of this kind of non-linear variety. Now, I'm just going to give you a few categories from Wenger just to help us to name some of these things that are going on in classrooms and that are going on in churches when we come together on a Sunday morning. First, he says, two processes going on in any group, going on in this group right now. Participation and reification. Now, participation, he means almost what you or I mean by it the rest of the week, right? How you take part. Except he doesn't necessarily mean active participation, right? Even if right now your form of participation is sitting back in your chair with your arms folded waiting for me to say something interesting, that's still how you're taking part in this particular group. right? Your form of participation could be refusing to actually actively take part as expected by the group, but that's still your form of participation. So he means this in a very broad way. It's just the way you can take part in this group. Right now, my mode of participation involves standing up and talking a lot. Yours doesn't. And because, again, we're in a certain learning setup here, and that's the way it's going right now. So different kinds of participation are going to be open to different people at different moments in time. Different kinds of participation might be more or less plausible to certain people at certain points in time. I might have students in my class who, for cultural reasons, find it much harder to raise their hand and offer an opinion than other students in my class. So different forms of participation are more or less available to them. At the same time, there's a process of reification. That's a word I guess a few of us have used since last week. Reification simply means taking abstract things and turning them into objects. Right? Latin res, thing. So it just means thingification. Right? Turning something into a thing. So simple example. Suppose towards the end of this hour, I'm kind of losing my concentration on you folk, and I'm suddenly overcome by warm, tender feelings towards my wife. One of the things I could do with that is on the way home stop by a flower shop and buy a bunch of flowers and show up with those at home. Might not be a bad idea, actually. What I've now done is I've taken this somewhat nebulous sort of concept of care, right, and I've turned it into a thing, an object, a bunch of flowers, which now represents that care. And now that it's an object, we can negotiate with each other around it. I can hand it over with a big smile. She can give me a nice kiss. We can put them on the kitchen table, ready for the cats to destroy them. There's all kinds of other processes that can start taking place around this object. Once we've turned it into an object, it's public. We can both bump up against it. The abstract idea, it's harder for us to both bump up against. I've at least got to reify it in words, if we're going to do anything with it. But I often reify it in objects. It's something that applies to our setting right here. Which of these two classrooms reifies some educator's belief that group work is better than individual learning? Right, the one on the left. Which one doesn't? Right, the one on the right and the one you're sitting in, unfortunately. I've noticed this a lot since I came here to Calvin, actually. If you mess up the desks at Calvin and you tell students to put them back to normal, they put them back like this. Which point my comment is, okay, now we know what Calvin normal is, now let's decide what's going to help us. Right? So the way the furniture is laid out reifies, turns into a thing, a certain set of intentions about learning. You're here for your individual learning, you've got a little place for your own notes, you're not going to share with anybody else. And you don't really need to know what anybody else is doing to get your learning, right? You're here to learn one by one. You're an aggregate, you're not a community. So the layout of the furniture is doing that. Once these reifications have taken place, certain things become harder. Right? If I on the way home I go spend the $20 that's in my pocket on some sushi or something, I now can't buy a bunch of flowers, right? It's the choices constrain future choices. Once somebody has bought this furniture for my classroom, it's now harder for me to do group work, because I've got to move it every time I want to do group work, and that's going to create noise, and it's going to create chaos, and there's going to be bags in the way, and so on, and suddenly my job's more difficult. Likewise, giving a test might be harder in this classroom, and being sure that nobody can actually look over anybody else's shoulder and that kind of thing. So these two processes of participation and reification, they pull against each other. Sometimes they work together. I've got exactly the set of objects in my environment that help people to participate in the ways I want them to participate. Sometimes they work against each other. Back to our first example. My son's religion teacher wanted him to understand Christian theology. Her reification, the worksheet she had, and the test that she had, did not help that to happen. They were the wrong reifications for that kind of participation. They produced a different kind of participation. And now we've got a tug of war going on between these two processes. Right? She wants understanding, but she's actually getting passive recognition. Okay, over time, there's a lot more to Wenger. I'm simplifying like crazy here. But over time, these build up, and we get what Wenger calls a repertoire. We get the way we do things. And if you've been part of this group more than 3 weeks, you know that this is the way we do things. Right? You don't need to be told anymore. You don't need to be... My German 123 student, 3 weeks into the semester, even if I say nothing on a Friday, they come up and put pieces of paper on my desk on a Friday because they know that Friday is homework day. Right? I probably have to say that week one, week two. After that, it's the way we do things. They don't do that in the next classroom. They just do it in my classroom. Just like you don't necessarily, you know, you move to a different church and suddenly you find the way we do things is not the way we do things. I vividly remember once sitting in a quiet, genteel, very kind of white, middle-class vineyard prayer meeting in Toronto. And one of the slightly more flamboyant members of the group had actually met a total stranger on the street on the way to the prayer meeting and invited him along and brought him into the prayer meeting, who was clearly from a different kind of church background. I think it was a variety of Pentecostals. I hope I'm not going to injure anybody's feelings around these varieties of church. I'm not criticising either one. I'm just pointing to the mismatch here. So in our group, people were sitting here sort of with these kind of, you know, semi-allowed prayers in little small groups. And then until the visitor plucked up courage to take part, and suddenly everybody stopped in their tracks, went over from one side of the room. We heard, "Lord, we beseech thee!" Right? And sort of went on in this kind of, you know, very stentorian voice, King James kind of language sort of prayer. And everybody was... Because again, not our repertoire, right? Somebody else's repertoire. Normal in that setting, not normal in this setting. So that's simply what Wenger means by repertoire. Now, here's an example of repertoire.
You can't stop it. It's coming to a town near you. It used to be called contemporary. Some call it relevant. We're so cool, we call it temperament.
Welcoming all with gravity and cool glasses, I welcome everybody with arms wide open, revealing my tattoo so you know I have a past. Quick transition to the band, invite everyone to stand. Let's do it.
This is the song that everyone knows. It's the song that everyone knows. My new song. Ushers up as we prepare for our offering. Feel free to give if you feel led. It's between you and God, but we're tracking it. One man has all the answers.
I have all the answers. Showing a picture of a puppy and or a baby from an impoverished third world nation.
Speaking softly to draw you in.
And then emphatically, driving home my point.
On pause. Whispering. Repetition.
Still pausing. Pained expression. Long prayer so that the worship leader can get back on stage.
This is the closing song with strings that'll make you cry.
Coming soon to your town, a new kind of church. You will be lifted high and challenged to grow. We call that Growtivation. You call this Sunday Morning.
Do you know, it was actually made by an emergent church. I don't remember its name, but if you search for Sunday Morning the movie, it's on various places on the internet. So one of the interesting things about this is that it was made by a church that was actually satirizing its own Sunday morning liturgy. Right? So it was a self-parody. But what I think they've done very effectively is exactly what Wenger's talking about. They've looked at their Sunday morning service, and instead of looking at the content, right, you know, the topic we're preaching about or whatever, they've isolated the repertoire. What are the moves that we make, and what do those moves mean? And what kinds of messages are coming through those moves to the people who are taking part? It was kind of funny. I when I first discovered this, that morning I'd been at one of the local larger churches and done exactly that liturgy, every single move. So it was really this sudden moment of total recognition when I saw the video there. This is a whole YouTube genre, by the way. It's sort of videos that take, for instance, movies and take out the content and just name the moves. And some of them are really quite funny. So first question here to be sort of thinking about as we meander onwards is what if you could make one of those for your own church? You had to make a repertoire clip. Right? And it would contain no content, right? You couldn't use any theological words or any actual message, but you simply had to name all of the behaviors that are engaged in that frame the worship service from the beginning to the end and what those behaviors might imply. Now, there might be more than one way of doing that because we don't all interpret the same behaviors the same way. I suspect that some of us react in individual ways to things. I know in my own church, I've had the experience at times of the worship leader saying in between songs something like, and the next song we're going to do is, before starting the next song. Now, I'm afraid for me, psychologically, that evokes the concert genre, not the church genre. It immediately distances me from what's going on in the worship service. It immediately makes me think I'm listening to some kind of folk musician who's about to sort of play their next hit. It's the wrong cue, right? So, now, I don't know whether everybody else in the meeting is having that same reaction to that cue, right? You'd actually have to ask everybody to find out. So it'd be an interesting kind of exercise maybe to get a group together and try to brainstorm what would this clip look like for your church? What would the moves be and how would you name them? Now, staying with Wenger for a moment. People are participating in certain ways. There's objects that we've created in our environment that reveal our intentions in certain ways. That builds up into a repertoire, the way we do things. And what this shapes over time is our imagination. Now, when Wenger talks about imagination, he's not talking about fantasy or creativity. He's talking about the way you see things, what the world is to you right now. What do you think we're doing right now in this room? That's part of the way you construe this activity. What do you imagine is going on? He gives a couple of illustrations of this process of work. He says, I remember once standing with my children around a globe and pointing proudly, this is where we live. They were duly impressed, not for a moment doubtful, yet a little puzzled, and I started to reflect on the kind of process by which it made sense to indicate a point on a globe and claim it's where we live. It was not imagination as opposed to fact, because the issue was not whether what I was saying was factual. That issue was constructing a picture of the world such that it did make sense to point to a globe and say that we lived there. We talked about the Earth, the solar system, and gravity, and from that perspective, I think that it did seem rather exciting to them to think that indeed we lived there, little stick figures glued to a huge revolving planet. So again, something that it's factual, it's not fantasy, it's not fiction, whatever, but nevertheless, in order to be able to say we live here, you've got to have this whole picture in your mind of how the world is, what the universe is, how the universe is put together. Another of his examples, he says, you're going down the road. Two stonecutters are asked what they're doing. One responds, I'm cutting this stone in a perfectly square shape. The other responds, I'm building a cathedral. Both answers are correct and meaningful, but they reflect different relations to the world. The difference between these answers does not imply that one is a better stonecutter than the other, as far as holding the chisel is concerned. At the level of engagement, they may well be doing exactly the same thing. But it does suggest that their experiences of what they are doing and their sense of self in doing it are rather different. This difference is a function of imagination. As a result, they may be learning very different things from the same activity. So this is why imagination is important to Wenger. He says you could be doing exactly the same things, but another important ingredient here is what you think is happening. So this is why I just brought up the example I did. When our worship leader says, and the next song I'm going to do is, that cues my imagination in certain ways. And it means I take away certain things from that experience. Maybe the person next to me, maybe it doesn't cue them that way, right? And maybe they're actually lost in worship and it's wonderful and so on, right? Exactly the same moves going on, right? So this kind of complicates the picture a little bit because it's not like there's a one-on-one correspondence between the moves you make and what people take away from those moves, right? It's not mechanical. It's filtered through what people think is happening when certain moves take place. So that actually means if you want to be intentional about what people learn in a group, you've got to manage not only the moves, you've got to think about the objects and what moves we're going to make and what they're going to mean, but you also need to have a narrative going on about what those moves mean so that we all end up with a similar interpretation of what's going on. And that's what the best liturgy does, right? A set of moves with a narrative that make sense of those moves. So, participation, reification, imagination, repertoire. Wenger's simply trying to describe here what happens when groups of people come together and do stuff. Could be a church, could be an office, could be a classroom, could be any kind of setting where you do stuff together over time. Certainly includes church worship services, certainly includes school classrooms. Now, I'm just finding for myself that it starts to help me to name things that I see in my classroom and in my church. And this is connected with this whole notion of formation. Wenger says, in the process of sustaining a practice, doing stuff together, we become invested in what we do as well as in each other and our shared history. Our identities become anchored in each other and what we do together. As a result, it's not easy to become a radically new person in the same community of practice. Conversely, it's not easy to transform oneself without the support of community, as reflected by the countless support groups proposed by the self-help industry. So he talks about what he calls an identity of participation, right? My identity is not separate from my communities of practice. I'm part of this church community for 20 years. That shaped who I am. It shaped what I find comfortable. It shaped the kind of moves I'm used to making. It shaped the way I respond to those moves, right? My identity is being shaped by these participations, the things that I'm taking part in. So learning's taking place. Maybe before we ever get to the sermon. Now, little example of how these things interact. When I moved to Grand Rapids, I joined a church here, and one of the practices of our church that I really like is, and it's not an unusual practice, I've seen lots of other churches, but is that when we get to the part of the service, when we're done singing and we're about to have a sermon, in between, the pastor stands up at the podium at the front with a Bible, and then the request is that everybody stand for the reading of the Word of God. And we all stand up, and we read the Bible passage, and there's a little liturgical gesture, and then we sit, right? So there's this little, again, this is reification. The abstract intention is the Bible's more important than other books, right? This is to be honoured. We reify that in standing up for a couple of minutes while we read the Bible and sitting down again. We don't do that for other books, so we've reified this difference in status between the Bible and the other stuff that we read outside this service, or the church bulletin, or even the stuff on the PowerPoint screen. So I like that. That seems to me a good reification. And the fact that every Sunday the request also goes out, please stand for the reading of the Word of God, means imagination is being managed as well as repertoire. Right? We're constantly being told what this is for. It's not just stand up, everybody, and we, you know, half of us don't really quite know what's going on. But there's a story that goes along with it. Now, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, we got this kit for the first time. Before that, we just had an overhead projector with, you know, about 500 of those hard-to-file song acetates. And suddenly we got the projector hanging from the ceiling and the screen and so on and so forth. And it was really interesting to watch the adjustment process. Because now we've just put some new things into our repertoire, and the rest of the repertoire starts adjusting about around it. Very first thing that happened was we stopped standing up for the reading of the Word of God. And the really interesting thing was that when this had happened 2 weeks running, and I wrote to my pastors about that and asked if why we'd done this, nobody was aware that we'd stopped doing it. We'd just quit doing it. Nobody had actually stood and said, let's not do this anymore. They just kind of hadn't done it, right? And had just passed by that moment in the service. Why? Well, what do you think? I've got my theory, but what do you think? Why would we quit doing that? Because we bought a projector. Something we Right, I think that's part of it. You get an interruption, and suddenly the rhythm stops, right? And suddenly you're out of rhythm, right? You're not going the same way. I think that's one thing. Yeah.
You don't have a leader standing up and doing the reading, so it's just sort of, you know, not obvious the change in fluctuation or
right.
Whatever.
Certainly the focal point changed from being on a person standing at the front of the podium to us all looking up the screen at the side. So that was something that shifted that helped this kind of interruption. Yeah. What else?
I'm guessing that the scripture was up there, but there's Absolutely. No object
right.
of respect and honor unfolded in front of them for them to pay, you know, to
right. Exactly. Yeah, the scripture was now on the screen. It was reified in a different way, right? The Word of God is now not reified as a book, it's reified as a screen. Now, how many people pay exaggerated respect to screens? We have a long tradition of paying exaggerated respect to books right, going back to the Middle Ages with huge ones being carried around and chained across the church and so on. We've known that books are really important for 500 years. Screens? Now, what do people do with screens? What's the repertoire that goes with screen?
TV.
Right, TV, movies. And what do you do with it? What's your repertoire when you have a screen in front of you? You sit back, right? You sit back and you expect things to come to you and you passively absorb them and you get informed or entertained or provoked or whatever it is, but you certainly don't stand up and sort of pay attention while they're going on. We pretty much only do that with people. We don't do it with screens. So I think all of those things together, we've got an interruption in the rhythm, we've got a shift of actual physical focus from this place to this place, and it's now a screen and not a book. And suddenly the repertoire has changed, and suddenly this whole thing that we wanted to do has gone away. And as soon as I actually sort of, you know, said time out and sent the email, suddenly it's like, oh no, we didn't want to stop doing that. We started doing it again, right? We picked up the rhythm again. So again, it's not like it's impossible to coexist with the screen. But the screen brought its own repertoire with it. It brought its own learning structure with it that was going against their intentions in terms of the way the worship service was planned. Now, I'm sort of bouncing back and forth classroom churches here. When I first started here at Calvary, first semester, the thing that most bugged me, I never taught in a Christian college before and I never taught in North America before, it's still beauty. And the thing that probably most bugged me in the first semester was this. And it was the fact that it seemed to me that people were very focused on their own individual learning. The place where that really became clear to me was when about 10 weeks into the first semester, I gave a student a bunch of quizzes and asked if she could help me give them out, back out to the class. And it became clear very, very quickly that she didn't know the names of two-thirds of the people in the room, 10 weeks into the semester. I'd been calling on people by name the entire semester. And that sort of drew my attention to this. And the more I reflected on it, the more it did seem to me that a lot of the time, the default expectation was, I've paid my tuition to get my learning. I'm here to learn what I need to learn. I get my grade for it. I get my GPA. And if somebody else is having a problem, that's the professor's problem, right? That's not my problem. I'm here for my learning, not their learning. And whether or not the person next to me is failing is probably none of my business. That's not part of my responsibility for being in this class. Well, the second semester, one of my students asked me to mentor him. And so we started meeting once a week and reading scripture and reading philosophy and all kinds of stuff. And so one day we were sitting having a coffee and I was just venting about this and just sort of saying, how is this Christian? You know, love your neighbour as yourself. The weakest part of the body deserves the greatest attention. Am I my brother's keeper? Sure you are. So this just doesn't seem to me to be a Christian way to do learning. What stayed with me from that conversation was that this is, I think, one of the most deeply thoughtful, most ardently spiritual students that I've encountered. He was eloquent in his desire to serve the Lord and to think it all through and so on. He'd been to Christian elementary school, Christian middle school, Christian secondary school, 2 years at Wheaton College, 2 years at Calvary College. And I don't know how many churches along the way. And this was a brand new idea to him. What, you mean part of my Christian discipleship? I could be helping the person sitting next to me in class with their learning. That's really cool. And I'm like, how do you get through 20 years of Christian education and help the person next to you be a new idea? Well, again, maybe it's a lot to do with repertoire, reification, forms of participation, sitting in these kinds of seating arrangements, getting individual grades for your work, having it drilled into you that you don't copy off other people and you don't collaborate and you make sure it's your own work. Can't turn in if it's not your own work. And so on. This whole ethos which reinforces a social value of individualism and that fits American society very well. I mean, it's not accidental that it's this way. We tend to get the kind of schools that the society could be guaranteed to produce. It's reflected in a lot of our educational behaviours. Someone told me a story about teaching with First Nations kids in an elementary school. And after a little while, a delegation of Native American kids came up to the Anglo-American teacher and said, we need to talk to you. We think your grading is unfair. I sometimes ask my education students, why was the grading unfair? And they never get it, right? Because they, start predicting, well, somebody got a grade that was too high or too low, or in other words, what we think of as fairness is, did the individual grade match the individual learner? What these kids said was, they said, we think your grading is unfair because you give us individual grades. It was their case. They said, how can it be fair if one kid in the class is not understanding the material to just penalise that kid with a bad grade as if it weren't all of our responsibility that they're not succeeding? Again, that fits very well with certain Native American cultures. It fits less well with mainstream American culture. But it's just one of those, and I'm not necessarily saying that's the right way, this is the wrong way, but these things just make the repertoire visible to you. One of the ways you learn to be an individual is you always get your own score. So individualism reflected in learning. Now, a step further, and this is a church example, believe it or not, when I get there. I was reading some research in cross-cultural psychology, and really interesting study where they took, well, first of all, the baseline. If you take two groups of people, and the one on the left are, let's say, Japanese, and the ones on the right are Anglo-American, and you give them a psychological value scale, a question, you know, one of these 40-question questionnaires where you then plot yourself on a scale and so on. Well, no surprises that the Japanese respondents come out with a very strong community emphasis. It's all about social relationships. And the Anglo-American respondents come out with a very strong individualist emphasis. It's about me and my responsibility and my choices. No surprises there. That's what every text on cross-cultural psychology will tell you about differences between Asian and Western psychology. But here's the really interesting thing about this particular study. What they did next was they took these two groups. Actually, I had these the wrong way around. These are the Anglo-Americans and these are the Japanese. They took these two groups and they mixed them up. So now you've got two groups that both consist of some Japanese folk and some Anglo-American folk over here and some Japanese folk and some Anglo-American folk over here. And then they gave both of the groups a little passage out of a short story. And they had them go through this passage, and the group on the left had to go through and underline all the words for I, me, and my. And the group on the right had to underline all the words for we, us, and our. And then, right after they did that, they gave them the psychological value scale questionnaire. Well, lo and behold, the people on the left come out as individualists, and the people on the right come out as communitarians. In other words, it takes a nudge as small as underlining words in a passage, drawing your attention to certain things to cause a temporary shift in your value system. It's a temporary shift, because the moment these folk walk out of the experimenter's room, they're back in a society that is constantly sending them one or the other message. So if you're North American, you go back out into a society, for instance, where you go to the restaurant, the tables are square so that each person gets a side, you get given a menu each, you get asked to eat one by one, each person, what you want to order, and so on. If you go to a restaurant in China, that would all be different. You'd have a round table. One person would order for everybody else. No one would dream of giving everybody a separate menu. Right? So you're embedded in all of these practices that are constantly telling you you're an individual, you're an individual, you're an individual. But take someone out of that for a moment. Just get them to go through a story and underline we, us, and our. And for 10 minutes, their value system changes. Right? I find this a fascinating area of research. Human beings are very malleable. It's almost scary. I mean, there was a study I read recently that when teachers are grading work, for example, in school, one of the things that's been measured to make a difference to what grades they give to students is whether or not they're holding a warm drink. Makes you feel better about the world, right? You're a little bit more generous. So we're very susceptible to these little nudges from our environment. Theologically, this doesn't surprise me, because I do actually think, this is a whole other topic, that we were actually created to be part of a body. I don't actually think we were created to be rugged individualists who function separately from everybody else. We're intertwined. We nudge each other all the time in certain directions. It's back to what Wenger's talking about. Now, here's how this is a church example. Shortly after I read this, I was, again, at my own church. This isn't my church, but I just found this video of this song. And that Sunday, my pastor preached an eloquent, well-constructed and impassioned sermon telling us not to be individualists, talking about Christian community and our responsibility for each other and our responsibility to care for each other. And American society is all about individual success and standing on your own two feet and so on, but that's not the gospel and so on. And he did a bang-up job. It was a good, hard-hitting, incisive cultural critique, and you've got to be different, right? This was preceded by about 40 minutes of worship. Now, I was primed by this stuff I'd been reading and I was observing through the worship the kind of songs that we were singing. Now, this is one of the songs that we sang that morning.
This is the air I breathe.
We didn't sing it quite like this.
This is the air I breathe. Your holy presence.
Balanced by yous in terms of the cold lyrics on paper, right? But in terms of the musical accents, where are all the emphases? Where are all the high notes? Where are all the drawn out notes, etc.? It's always on I or me, right? None of the yous are emphasized. And in fact, if we were to play that back and watch it frame by frame, you even see how it's affecting her body language. Because all of the gestures are the I and the me, right? They're not the, right, the you, right? It's, this is where the focus is, and I think she's feeling that as she sings the song, and the gestures are expressing that, are reifying that sensation. We sang about 12 more songs like that. I don't remember what they all were, but I know that consistently for half an hour, the musical worship fell on the words, the musical emphasis fell on the words I and me. Go back to our experiment here. How do you turn somebody from a community? How do you turn Japanese people into individualists? All you need to do is give them a paragraph and get them to underline all the words I, me, and mine. And for the next 10 minutes, you can give them a values questionnaire and they're going to come out as individualists. So what we just did at church was we spent 40 minutes priming people to be individualists, and then we sent the pastor up to tell them to be communitarians. He was probably wasting his breath at that point. Especially when you start relating this, now I'm going to use some research imprecisely here, this is just a hunch, but something that seems related. There was a study just recently about the study how middle school and high school kids relate to allegedly historical movies, right? Hollywood versions of history. And the finding of this, it wasn't that surprising, it was that if the teacher teaches the correct version of the history in the class, and the students watch the movie that has the history all wrong, the version they remember is the movie version. Right? It's more emotionally compelling. It's more vivid. Right? It connects at more levels than the teacher's narrative. The only way you start to make an inroad is if the teacher explicitly points out the things in the movie that are wrong. And again, it's this drawing attention to, right? This priming. Then you can start to dent the holes that this movie account has on the student's imagination. But just having them watch the movie and then telling them what the real story is, that doesn't do anything. Now, that's not exactly the same as what was going on in church, but I do wonder which was more affectively compelling, which was more emotionally compelling. The 30 minutes of elegantly written songs, with us all singing, with 500 of us simultaneously singing I, rather than daring to let the word we cross our lips on a Sunday morning, and followed by one guy standing up and explaining for 20 minutes why this is a really bad idea. Which of those has more learning in it? Now, the answer to that, of course, is I don't know. It's going to vary from individual to individual. Some people maybe were really impacted by the sermon, and like me, can still remember it, and like me, were cynical about the worship. But I suspect there were other people for whom the worship was the more important learning experience than the sermon. The participation, the taking part in the repertoire, that giving me a certain identity of participation, that this is who I am right now. Again, temporary. If I go to one worship service and I go back out on the street, and then there are more powerful formative forces than the hour I spent in church. But if I keep coming back, it's a regular pattern for this over time, and I'm part of the same church for a few years, then this starts shaping an identity of participation. It starts to be how I do Christian. And this is starting to be who I am. So, some of you may have heard my colleague Jamie Smith talking. I know he's doing about 10 things on this conference. But this is one of his big themes at the moment. It's this thing, how do we... There's enough formative processes out there. How does the church become a powerful enough formative agent that it can maybe start pushing back on the kind of formation that's taking place when you go to the mall? Where somebody doesn't stand at the entrance of the mall and preach to you for 20 minutes about being a good consumer. They do it instead with architecture and nice music and attractive pictures and smells. And they understand how communities of practice work. They know how learning works. How does the church attend to the kinds of learning taking place? Now, I guess my fond hope is that most of what I've said has been superfluous to you because your church is much better at this than mine. I look at what we do and I suspect that an awful lot of the actual learning that takes place during worship is incidental and unplanned. It's like my son's learning on that worksheet at the start. Nobody knew that we would learn that because we hadn't actually thought about it. We just kind of do the way we do things, and the messages people are taking away from where we put the seats, and if we have a choice about that, which songs we choose, what the sequence of the songs is, what the person says in between the songs, do they stand on a stage, do they not stand on a stage? All those choices, right, those are all learning choices. So my bottom line here, you know, I can sum up in a sentence what I wanted to say. It's all learning. And maybe some of the things we don't call learning are more powerful learning than some of the things we do call learning. The adult Sunday school might not be where all the learning's taking place. It may well be in the worship. Probably where an awful lot of it's happening. I've gone on a little longer than I wanted to, but we do still have some time for questions, conversation, discussion.
This is fantastic. This is something I've never thought of before. I'm loving it. I'm wondering if you can give us more examples besides what you just did, speech, stage, music choice. What else in the church are we teaching wrongly?
Well, here's another example that's a big can of worms that I'll try and do really quickly. Church I was in England. At one point we did actually manage to sit down and completely reconstruct the way that children participated in our church. Now this was again in the British context, things are pretty sad generally, and we actually found we were a small church, but at one point we had nobody in our church between the ages of 12 and 30. Nobody. As soon as they were old enough to exert their own will, they left. But when we started looking and we started actually talking to the kids and actually listening to what they felt about how they participated and so on, we found that pretty much the modes of participation that kids had in our church were to be sent off into a separate room to do their own thing, or if they were integrated into the main service, to perform for the adults in a cutesy kind of way. So you get kind of the little children's choir turn or whatever. So what children do for adults is perform for them. That conversation before and after the service did not involve children, that if you had observed our church services, you would have conversations at different altitudes. So there'd be a 5 foot off the ground conversation between all the adults that would be all about your week and prayer requests and wasn't the service wonderful and so on, and there'd be another conversation 3 feet off the ground that was about totally other things. And what I wasn't seeing happening was adults walking into church and walking up to a 10-year-old and saying, oh, what happened in your week and can I pray for you? And so on. So we started very consciously working on all of those kinds of things, right? And whether the children were actually allowed to give voice to concerns, were actually allowed to... was the children's sermon, the way we were doing it, a good idea? Because it actually tended to patronize both the children and the adults. or could we find better ways of doing that? And again, it would take a lot longer to go into some of our solutions, but we started trying to build a conscious community of practice in the church where, simply as a first step, where adults didn't talk down to kids, right, and didn't treat them as cute little things that you sort of smile at every now and then, but you wouldn't come in and share your prayer request with. But maybe you actually come into church and sort of go up to a 10-year-old and say, you know, I really need prayer for this, would you pray for me? Think how formative that would be over time if 100 people did that every Sunday morning, in terms of building a certain kind of... So sometimes it's these little small repertoire moves, right, that are who talks to whom is another big one, and for how long and about what. Go ahead.
I don't think I want to open a can of worms, but given this model, how does the male and female roles affect? I know a lot of contemporary music is very female, which means the males are not going to participate as much in the same way.
Yeah.
They might not be so gushy about God. As
I don't respond real well to some of this.
Exactly. And so then, what are we teaching? What's the church teaching by making that the focus of our music? Is whether you get into it is
oh, absolutely. Yeah, awful lot of gender stuff around this. Yeah. And what do men and women get to do and what do they say and how do they say it? And all of those kinds of things is all part of this picture too.
Okay.
And it's all part of the learning that's going on. And it's all part of what the kids are participating in as well.
And
so there's generational learning going on in that too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The men's lack of interest is going to get picked up by a child.
Well, actually, my wife was just telling me the other day, I'm quoting this secondhand, so I have no idea about the source, but she was just reading something where the father's church attendance is a better statistical predictor of children's future church attendance than the mother's church attendance.
And it's going down. There's more women than
it should,
right?
Yeah.
Do you have any more resources that we could delve into?
I don't really. This is kind of a new idea for me, in a sense, is trying to apply... Because most of my work is with teachers, as you may have been able to tell from the slight bias of my examples. And so, actually, this is the first time I've come to Worship Symposium, and it's the first you're the first group with whom I've ever tried to connect this into church. So this is kind of a new idea for me. So I don't have a backlist of off-the-shelf stuff. I do have kind of a notion that it might be fun to write something about this at some point, and maybe that would be useful. So,
I'm a former educator and now worship coordinator, so some of the things, too.
Good combination.
And I just read a recent article on the different learning styles and what that means for our worship too, and when we analyze in that regard, we're finding a lot of visual, or not so much visual, but a lot of auditory learning, and that's another helpful way of viewing and analyzing our worship services.
Yeah, that's another huge. That ties right back into this whole thing. When we tried to reconstruct my church in England with the children's participation, what we started to realize about the children's sermon was that often we were kind of watering down the topic and then presenting it in a very traditional way. So you were trying to take this very simple childlike topic and then just kind of preaching about it a little bit, maybe with a little object lesson. And we ended up trying to flip that and trying to say, well, if we do anything intergenerational in the church, if we keep the kids in for the sermon every now and then and so on, we're actually going to try and take a really challenging topic, but then think really hard about how you communicate that so that everybody can learn it. Now, the immediate thing we found was that this caused great outbursts of positive feedback from those members of our church who were not educated past high school, right? Who weren't sitting full of deep joy that they got to listen to a 30-minute lecture every Sunday. I'm making a big generalization there. People that have different learning styles. But certainly, you know, there were folk in our church with PhDs, and there were folk in our church who would much rather have some really vivid illustrations and so on, but didn't want kiddie content. Right? We were kind of condescending to everybody the way we did the children's sermon. And when we tried to make it really hard-hitting, but think more about the medium, right? Think about how we communicated it so that people who like visual learning, people who didn't like a lot of abstract concepts, didn't like a lot of words, right, etc., we suddenly found it wasn't just the kids, right? That all kinds of other people were more involved. So,
Time, too, because I know in our church we often we want one of our values to be that we are all participating, and that it is an entertainment, except that it's a big, long church with lots of long, straight pews faced that way, where we all sit. But it is interesting, you know, we have a couple of different pastors, and one of them is a wonderful speaker, but it tends to be long. And there's a settling in that says, okay, maybe I'm half checking out, you know, I don't know that I'm engaged, whereas the children's message is really one of those minor moments of our service, because there is an object lesson, and we usually, people are very good about taking the scripture and the sermon topic and giving a core thing. I think the adults tend to get a lot out of that.
Yeah.
versus, and it's more participatory, it's laugh and have a little bit of humor, so you're engaged, but then this time spent in the message becomes, you know, I'll just sit and let you do this at me, and I don't know that people are getting
it. It's a ceremonial passing of the mints. Checking the BlackBerry. Yeah, time is another variable in this. How you use time, pace, which things go fast, which things go slow, that's all another part of this reality that we'll be talking about as well. Which things are hurried, which things are squeezed in, which things are left out if the time runs out, and which things are non-negotiable. All of those are also part of the implicit learning frame. So, yeah.
Place and liturgy fit into your learning. Liturgy, purposeful liturgy.
Yeah.
Where I have been to churches where the priest gets up and he's the communicator without any participation of those gathered.
Right.
So we moved away from liturgy to 7-Eleven.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And this is implicitly a defense of liturgy as well. I mean, this is what liturgy historically is meant to do, is to be intentional about this. Right? It's to make you walk through a certain story every Sunday with a set of moves that go with it, kneeling in the right places and so on. Again, I'm not a liturgical scholar, right? So this is all sort of opinion from here on in. But I also think that when you look at that Emergent Church video, right, the Sunday morning is coming, they have a liturgy too. It's just a different kind. There's still a set of moves that we go through. It just may or may not be the ones we want. So the question then becomes, which liturgy, right? What is the liturgy expressing? What does it need to express this Sunday? And to maybe get outside thinking, my church has a liturgy or my church doesn't have a liturgy. I go to a very low church. It probably would not think of itself having a liturgy. But, oh, it has a liturgy. Mm-hmm. There's a certain order things are done in. There are moves that get made regularly. There are things that get said regularly and so on. If we could sit down and talk about that, I suspect we might change some of it.
Without a creative adult education program, constant, purposeful liturgy from the scripture. Do that.
I think you could do a lot of it, especially if you think about imagination, not just participation, right? How are you getting people consciously involved in what they're doing, and so on. Yeah, liturgy is meant to be formative. That's part of what it's there for. It doesn't mean there aren't other things that one could usefully do in an adult education classroom. Of course, how we do adult education is a whole other question, whether that's a lecture and so on, or whether there's other things that should be happening in adult education. It's another set of questions related to this. Well, thank you all for being my guinea pigs.
Thank you.